The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoon Technology Consulting, a global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy. So, welcome to Secure in Mind, and I have two guests on the podcast. I'll introduce the first one, who I know very well and who knows me very well. She is my sister, and she is the backup for the conversation that we are going to have. Her name is Dr. Melissa Kelly, and we are speaking with an extremely special guest, and I really wanted to chat with him after hearing him on another podcast, which I listened to, which is the Intelligence Matters podcast with Michael Morell. His name is Dr. Anthony Fauci, and I'm looking forward to this first ever Secure in Mind three-person conversation thing with medical knowledge that I have no idea about. So welcome, Dr. Fauci, and welcome, Dr. Kelly. This is exciting for me. This is a new evolution, so we'll see how it goes. So look, Dr. Fauci, let's start with your background, and we can sort of preface that by considering the podcast that you did with Michael. I thought it was a fascinating conversation. This sort of angle was the national security angle, which fits in very well with this podcast, although this podcast audience is predominantly more European Union and Oceania. But what I was really impressed with was the amount of time that you've been in the, I don't know whether you would call it industry or in the thick of it, let's say. And I wanted to understand how much that has evolved over the years. And maybe that's a good place to start. So when you initially entered into the infectious disease and immunology field, how has that changed over the last many years? It's a very broad question.
but it's a good question to set the stage for what I think you're getting at. So yeah. I'm a classically trained physician in internal medicine. Mm-hmm. I went to medical school, did an internship, a couple of years of residency. And then I came down, that was in New York City. And I came down to Washington, D.C., to Bethesda, Maryland, to do a three-year, what was called a combined fellowship in clinical infectious diseases. But the research that I did was predominantly in immune-mediated disease and the interface between the immune system and infectious diseases. I did that for 3 years as a fellow. Then I went back to the New York Hospital, where I did my original training as a final year as chief resident in medicine, mm-hmm. To get an extra clinical training. And then I came back to the NIH in 1972. Mm-hmm. From 1972 to 1981, I was doing work on immune-mediated diseases, treating them with anti-inflammatory and immunosuppressive drugs, and looking at the host defense mechanisms associated with infectious diseases. That was all fine and well and good. And then in 1981, in the summer of 1981, everything changed. My life changed. My professional career changed. Everything changed. Okay. We had the first five cases of curiously gay men who were reported from Los Angeles with a very strange syndrome of a pneumonia that you only see in people who are immunosuppressed. So I was very puzzled by it. Mm. And I didn't make much of it. I thought it was a fluke. And then about a month later, in July of 1981, the second report came out, now with 26 men, curiously all gay, who were not only from LA, but from San Francisco and New York City, who presented not only with Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis pneumonia, but a variety of opportunistic infections. It was at that point that I made a decision that I said changed everything for me. I decided, although I had a relatively successful career going, studying these other diseases, I decided I would devote my attention to admitting to our hospital these men with a disease that had no name, a disease that had no etiology, and all of the patients were dying, literally within months to a year of when you saw them. And that really started the journey that I've been on for the last 38 and a half years now, that went from a disease that we didn't know what it was till we finally found out it was a new virus that we'd never experienced, human immunodeficiency virus. And it took a few years before we started developing therapies. Mm. We saw an amazing transition. Like from 1981, when I admitted the first patient to the NIH with this new disease, to the middle of the 1980s, we had absolutely no therapy at all. In 1983, when the virus was discovered, then we started screening for drugs, and the first drug was in 1987. Mm. And then from 1987 to 1996, things got a little bit better, but we didn't
much.
We didn't get a real knockout punch in the sense that one drug, and we were very happy, we had AZT. The virus went down a bit. Patients did well for a while, but as you might expect, because this was the kind of virus that mutates a lot, sooner or later it mutated and escaped the effect of the drug. And then over the years, we got more and more drugs until 1996, when we had a triple combination of drugs that was led by a drug called a protease inhibitor, even though we don't use much of that right now. But then it was the real game changer. And when given in a combination of three, then everything changed. We went from people who had essentially a 1 year life expectancy at the most, with few exceptions. There were those who obviously did well because of the biological variability, until now, fast forward to 2019, where you have a situation, if you get someone come into the same clinic that I admitted the first patient back then, you put them on a combination of three or more drugs in a single pill, you can actually look that patient in the eye and honestly tell them if they take their medication, they could likely live an additional 50 years, because the life expectancy now, it's not totally normal, but it's approaching almost the normal lifespan if you get somebody early enough before they destroy their immune system. So your question was, how has things changed? Mm. It's like night and day. The early years from 1981 through the early 1990s were what I described to my fellows and my students as the real dark years. You know, it was lightened only by the bravery of the patients, but it was really dark. Mm. And now, as your sister will tell you, it's different.
Right? Well, it's different. But we still have those, we actually still have a number of those patients who were around in those dark years. And that is what I find fascinating as a junior physician, I suppose, that some of these delightful gay men in their 60s have lived through 35 odd years, 38 years of having their ex-partners, their friends, their family die and waste away of this horrible condition. And they, for, as you say, biologic variability, have maintained their own health.
Right.
So, and now they're having all the problems that their contemporaries would have 20 years older. They're having cardiovascular disease. They have kidney problems from the drugs we used to give them. So the HIV in itself is relatively easy to suppress, as Dr. Fauci says, with one tablet, maybe two, with a combination of antiretrovirals. And people do live good lives.
Right. As you said correctly, I never would have imagined in my wildest dreams in 1982, 3, 4, that now I would be worrying about the cardiac
blood pressure
and blood pressure
and cholesterol. And what someone's total cholesterol versus their HDL is. That's right.
Well, I just
I didn't do 10 years of medicine for cholesterol management.
I just remember. I mean, it's close to home for us as well. My sister and I, because our uncle died of HIV, or I guess died of AIDS. What was it? The pneumonia that
I actually don't know. I mean, unfortunately, HIV. He died in 96, just before triple therapy came through, and he was I think 36 at the time, young gay man in Sydney. And I'm not sure what actually was the end result, but nonetheless, it was a wasting disease.
And
in St. Vincent's Hospital, no doubt, no less. So, where I ended up doing my residency 20 odd years later. So,
it's a positive spin on a negative situation. That was actually Dr. Fauci. That was something that I was going to ask, which is, I mean, this is something else that you mentioned in the podcast. How do you, prepare yourself for that kind of onslaught of darkness, with so many patients dying? It's got to be some sort of compartmentalizing of emotion and, separating here, pushing over there, because it's a lot of people that you sort of build a bond with, and then they're gone. And it may have felt quite hopeless at one stage.
Yeah, it's very difficult to describe. I had never really experienced that before, because for those 9 years that I mentioned to you from 1972 to 1981, I was fortunate enough to have developed some therapies for autoinflammatory diseases that were previously uniformly fatal. Mm. It used to be a disease called Wegener's granulomatosis, which is now called granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Mm. And there's about, you know, like a 95% lethality to the disease. And I developed a bunch of therapies, including low-dose cytotoxic drug with alternate-day corticosteroids that put 93% of them into remission.
And so, when you say you developed, was this when you were at the NIH as a medical scientist working in the lab portion of the medical? Okay,
exactly. I was doing clinical research and clinical protocols. I would study the effect on their immune system in the laboratory and report the immunological subtleties of it. But clinically, I would report them as a cohort of patients who otherwise had an almost completely lethal disease. Mm. We were able to turn around. So my life as a physician was one of taking people with dreaded diseases and giving them hope and having them walk out of the hospital when 10 years earlier they would have died. Mm. Then all of a sudden, just like switching a switch, I started to see patients that it was very frustrating because it was like putting a Band-Aid on a hemorrhage because we didn't know what we were dealing with. So those years were really, it was tough to adjust. You're right. I think you used the right terminology, Nick. You said compartmentalize, because if you didn't compartmentalize, there were no wins.
Yeah.
I mean, it was trying to alleviate suffering and trying to keep someone alive to enjoy some, you know, the rest of whatever they had with their family and loved ones. And that was it. Mm. That's the reason why when things turned around and we developed the drugs that absolutely changed things, it was like going from a very gray, cloudy, foggy day to all of a sudden sunlight. It's just really, really, really interesting.
And I think we need to make sure we don't forget the profound stigma and discrimination that was happening at the time and continues to this day. Mm. And so certainly it is physicians like Dr. Fauci and his contemporaries who actually said, well, you know, we are going to care for these gay men, whereas a lot of people didn't. Doctors didn't want to manage HIV. Mm. Nurses didn't. There's all these horrible stories of people having food left outside their room, so that parents, healthcare workers didn't have to touch a patient who was dying of AIDS. Mm. So it's an amazing privilege to be working in HIV now, I think. But I'm so mindful that a lot of the clients who I speak to have gone through this hideous discrimination to get to this point where we are now.
Mm. Right. That's very true.
I was going to, looking at both of your experiences, you're on the other sides of the world, and we did have touched on some of this conversation. I sort of caught in with it when I was rebooting my router, that you may know some doctors in common. From then and now, again, if we look at that, international cooperation. And I use this as a bit of a springboard into one of the topics that we'll be looking at later on in the podcast, which is international collaboration in containing pandemics, for example, and international collaboration. I mean, to me, it seems crazy how one could think that they could contain something across a border, across a land border, for example. But what was the international collaboration like with, say, for United States, Australia, but also some, you know, Western European countries, African countries as well, Latin America, and how has that progressed and how has that improved? Is it much better thanks to technology? Are there Slack channels? Are there group emailing lists and alerts that come up immediately, et cetera? So what do you think?
I think HIV is an example of extraordinary international collaboration. It really is. And the reason for that, Nick, is that when you have a disease that truly is a global pandemic, the experiences are very common from one country to another. And since we were dealing and still are, I mean, we haven't closed the book on this by any means. Mm. We're still dealing with advances in therapy, advances, you know, the quest to a vaccine. And since this is global, we have meetings, we report in the literature. There isn't anything that an Australian scientist would publish on HIV that I haven't read, and I think it would be vice versa the other day. because not only the literature is universal, particularly now that everything is online, we have international meetings. You know, I've been to at least two or three international meetings over the last 38 years in Australia. Where you sit down and meet with your colleagues. And even when there are meetings, be they in Paris, like we're having an international AIDS conference in Mexico City.
So you're there.
And, we run into all of our colleagues from Australia, from Africa, from Far East, the Middle East, South America. It really is a global community.
Yeah.
So the answer to your question is that the international collaboration, and the other thing is not only the fact that we know each other and we see each other and read each other's work. For example, my institute that I direct, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, you know, is overwhelmingly the largest funder of AIDS research in the world. We have a $3 billion research budget for AIDS. So years ago in the 80s, I established a network of clinical trials for treatment, for prevention, and for vaccine. We call it the Clinical Trials Network, the AIDS Clinical Trials Network, the Vaccine Network, the Prevention Network. And we have sites literally all over the world. So we do a study on prevention. For example, we did a multinational study on PrEP in gay men, because when we first did the pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis, and shown some years ago that if you give a single pill that contains two antivirals, and the pill is called Truvada, and you give it to someone who's at high risk for infection, and they actually take the pill and adhere, you can decrease by 95, 97% the likelihood that that person would acquire HIV infection. But we did the trial globally. So we have data from Australia, from Europe, from South America, from the United States. That is true international collaboration, because you're actually doing a clinical trial together.
Yeah, yeah. Melissa, is that similar to the one that you did in the prisons? Or was that hepatitis?
No, that's hepatitis C.
Okay.
That's hepatitis C.
Okay.
But certainly, I mean, within the viral hepatitis community as well, which is, you know, unfortunately not a great bedfellow with HIV, there's certainly international collaboration within a viral hepatitis perspective. Hepatitis B, we see quite a lot of co-infection with HIV, hepatitis B in some of our cohorts, especially people who come through from Southeast Asia, where the incidence and the prevalence of hepatitis B is much higher than in Australia, where we have vaccination, which is great. But certainly, my centre at the Albion Centre is involved in a lot of clinical trials. Some of which are publicly funded, of course, and then some of the funding comes through pharmaceutical companies. You know, not the enemy. We need to work with pharmaceutical companies to produce and to help them produce medications that can work. You know, as Dr. Fauci said, it's an international collaboration. The aim is to improve care and improve medication adherence and tolerability for HIV treatment and prevention.
So that actually leads me to another question, which is the integration of all these different entities which make up a certain community, if you will, of researchers, academics, doctors, physicians, the patients. The financial incentives for pharmaceutical companies to develop, say, antibiotics, for example. I was listening to one of your speeches at the Einstein Rockefeller CUNY CIFAR or something like that. Dr. Fauci, you mentioned, I think during that or one of the other speeches just prior to this podcast, was mentioning the financial incentives not being there or not structured when you have an antibiotic development.
Disincentive, in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a tough one to get around, right? It's, you know, I think about it from a security perspective. And, for example, if you're shipping out a bunch of, you know, security cameras, and you're shipping them out with 1 cent margin from a factory in, I don't know, another country
somewhere.
There's no incentive to build in any more security in that device, because hey, you're attacking what minimal margin you have. So you may as well invest your money where it makes sense. The problem is, and that can be easily compromised, much more easily than say one that you've spent more money and invested in more security. So I guess if you look at that sort of comparison. Working with pharmaceutical companies, I imagine that's much more than that's got a lot of negotiation, that's got a lot of back and forth, maybe some federal legislation to force some pharma companies to do things? How does that work?
Well, it's a complicated issue, Nick. The reason is that if the public health is the only motivating force for the investment in what it takes to make a pharmaceutical, and I think antibiotics are a very good example of that, that the thing that drives the motivation of the investment, the return on the investment, is the fact that you're dealing with a business plan. And even though ultimately you care about the public health, and of course there are many pharmaceutical companies that really do care about public health, they answer to their shareholders. And it takes hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion, to develop a drug. So what we have done to try and push the envelope for the development of a drug that in and of itself is not going to be a blockbuster, but is important for the public health. If there is a drug, a pharmaceutical, that a company is going to make that automatically is going to be used by a very large percentage of the population, they're going to use it every single day, and they could charge whatever they want for it, that is something that they don't need the National Institutes of Health. They don't need my team of researchers. They're going to make the investment, and they're going to take it from soup to nuts, from concept to product, because they know when they get the product, it's going to be a multi-billion dollar advance for them. However, there are certain interventions where you might only want to use it under certain circumstances, like an antibiotic that you'll use 10 to 14 days usually. You don't use it unless you know what you're dealing with, and sooner or later, there's going to be resistance to it. There's very little incentive for pharmaceutical companies to come up with a lot of new antibiotics against the resistant organisms. So what we try to do at the NIH is to get government funding to essentially help develop the concept, do the early clinical trials, do the preclinical work to alleviate, or what we call essentially lessen the burden of the pharmaceutical company or incentivize them to get involved in developing an antibiotic. But if we said, no, you go develop an antibiotic as you see fit, and we'll worry about what we need to do, that very few companies would come in. And the track record shows that, because we don't get a lot of brand new antibiotics. So one of the things where you have to partner with the company, essentially de-risk what they do, because their shareholders look at the risk. What is the risk of investing several hundred million to $1 billion to develop an antibiotic that will be sparsely used and ultimately go out of fad when resistance?
Can't sell.
They're not going to want to do that.
So you have
of de-risking.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to clarify for the non-medical people that from an HIV perspective, we expect that people take their antiretrovirals every single day for the rest of their foreseeable future at this time. So we've gone a little bit parallel here, talking about antibiotics for resistant bacteria rather than HIV.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And I think what Melissa's saying is that the pharmaceutical company needs no incentive to make an antiretroviral drug, because there are 37 million people living with HIV who would need to take a drug or a combination of drugs every day. So although we at the NIH did the ultimate funding of research to discover the virus, to demonstrate its vulnerable parts in the replication cycle, to start targeting antiretroviral drug, you don't have to worry about a company deciding they want to develop a new drug, because it's a multi-billion dollar enterprise. So it's entirely different from the antibiotics against antimicrobial resistant bacteria. It's a totally different story.
Wow. It's really interesting for someone who's not in an industry at all, seeing the it's like the curtains are opened a bit. So it's quite fascinating, and it does lead me to push on to the next area, where I want to get a sense of, I guess, infectious diseases outside of, say, HIV, and infectious diseases, pathogens, category A agents, botulism, plague, smallpox, anthrax,
In five minutes.
Yeah, give me a historical rundown. But I know that that you mentioned during, say, the Cold War years, the Soviets had large stockpiles of those category A agents, and so therefore the obvious defensive measure would be to ensure that you have plans in place, both for those man-made, man-assisted, I guess you might say, but also for naturally occurring potential pandemics. So there's that mangled question, and the other question that I wanted to slip in there was major events and catastrophic threats, and again tying that back into the potential man-made applied or weaponized types of scenarios that you could imagine, say the Soviet Union one that I mentioned. Your department, the NIAID, is it NIAID? Sorry. Yeah, is a partial responsibility for that department to forecast potential disasters and make the necessary mitigation strategies for that, and then advise the National Security Council on how to mitigate those strategies, whether man-made catastrophe or whether naturally occurring catastrophe. Have I got that right?
Yep.
There's a few questions in there, Nick.
We're going to unmangle that question, Nick.
Might need some post-editing.
So,
part one.
So, there has always been a concern about bioterror and the use of bioweapons, particularly because it became clear before the fall of the Soviet Union, it was well documented that they had stockpiled, smallpox, anthrax, botulism, plague, tularemia, and the hemorrhagic viruses, including Ebola, Marburg, and Lassa. Okay? So they had a big story for that. So what happened is that we had a small program of biodefense prior to 9/11 2001, when we had the combination of the Al-Qaeda attack on the United States, followed a month later by an anthrax attack that was felt to be possibly Al-Qaeda, and it wasn't. It was a homegrown terrorist who did it. But by the time we found out it was a homegrown terrorist, we had launched a major biodefense program. Mm-hmm. And the biodefense program was a substantial amount of money that I engaged in intensive negotiations with Tom Ridge, who was the Homeland Security, and with President George W. Bush himself, who gave my institute $1.6 billion to prepare against weapons of bioterror. So what we did is as you correctly said, we went through the category A agents and we developed a better smallpox vaccine. Mm. We developed antibodies against the toxins of botulism. We started developing an Ebola vaccine. So we checked all the boxes. Mm. But the thing that I think I was hopefully, and I was successful in convincing the authorities, including President Bush, who was very good and open-minded about it, that although you need to be prepared for deliberate acts of bioterror, the worst bioterrorist is nature itself. Mm. Because emerging and re-emerging infections have occurred, are occurring, and will always occur. Mm. So at the same time that you pick a particular pathogen to make an appropriate countermeasure in the form of a diagnostic, a therapeutic, or a vaccine, you've got to build up your capabilities of responding rapidly to any emerging infection, including pandemic influenza, including SARS, chikungunya, and Ebola, and Zika, and all of the things that we had to respond to. So there are two general pathways to do that, Nick. One, you pick out the pathogen and you do something about it, but then you prepare yourself for the unknown pathogen. Because we never even knew what the heck Zika was before it all of a sudden created great havoc in the Western Hemisphere.
And there's a big question. How do you prepare for the virus that you don't know?
Well, that's a very good question. There you go, Nick, you're on a roll. Hey. What you do is that you develop what's called platform technology. Instead of having to wait until the microbe strikes, isolate it, develop it, grow it, make a vaccine, you develop usually recombinant DNA technologies to have vaccine prototypes that you could just plug in whatever it is that you need. So the era of having to grow a virus, inactivate it or attenuate it, and give it as a vaccine, that is relatively passé. We still unfortunately do it a lot for influenza. We grow it in eggs. But the Ebola vaccine that we're using now, that we used in West Africa and that we're using in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, is a different type of a vaccine. It's a vector in which you insert the gene of the particular protein that you want to express so that you want the body to make an immune response against it. So the vaccine that we use in Ebola and in Zika isn't Zika and isn't Ebola. It's only a particular protein of that virus that you want the body to make an immune response about it. So you could start preparing that well ahead of time. That's the point.
Okay. Is it, Melissa, you would know more about this. There are more snakes in Australia. But is it kind of like
what, a snakes? Where are you going
to? Let me just connect this. Is it kind of like an anti-venom, a general anti-venom that isn't specifically for a red belly or a brown snake, but it can potentially cover all snakes? Am I getting it right?
Kind of. I must admit, my knowledge about anti-venoms is limited. I guess the argument is that you're using technology that already exists that might but will work across a variety of conditions or a variety of viruses in this case.
Yeah.
And then being able to, when the situation is needed, be able to, as Dr. Fauci said, pick the virus that you're trying to prevent and use that across the base. The base package, if you will.
Okay, so the mitigation is having the base protein. Was that right? And then, yeah,
the base—it's called a platform, Nick. That's the word they use. Like, it could either be a DNA platform, an RNA platform, a vector platform, a viral-like particle. You just perfect that particular platform, and then when a disease comes along, what do? Is sequence the virus and then stick the gene in and start making your vaccine.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay, I'll leave that one to the professionals. All righty. Following on with this, pathogens and cross-border collaboration in terms of mitigation strategies. Now, to give you an example, NIST is it's another federal United States federal body that kind of gives you the a framework for certain hygienic rules to follow, if you will, in the tech world. So, for example, the length of a password, the enumeration, and the different figures and symbols and stuff that you would chuck into that password is considered academia, private sector tests, research, and everything. And then they say this is the general, the golden standard, it's the platinum. And it's generally considered that organization, as well as maybe some other think tanks or research organizations around the world, are considered the platinum level, and everyone follows that. When we're talking about a pandemic which is potentially going to be taking lives, what kind of legislative pressure can international bodies like, for example, United Nations Health, press on governments in different nation states in order to align with best practice? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, the WHO should be doing that. Sometimes they do it well, and sometimes they do it not so well.
Yep.
But there is an organization, the World Health Organization, which generally sets the broad types of practices. We in the United States have what's called the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which established those kinds of broad guidelines of health. If there's an outbreak, they survey for an outbreak. When there is one, they try and identify it, and they create the public health rules. For example, when we had the situation with Zika that was coming from South America into Florida and Texas, they made the guidelines of travel, and they make suggestions, if not mandates, about where it's safe to go and not to go.
Okay.
They make those kinds of determinations about international travel if you're going to a place. They make the guidelines for vaccinations that people should give. So each individual country, and I'm sure Australia being, you know, very top-notch in that regard, has very similar things to what we do in the United States. So the vaccinations that we give our children here are very similar to what's given in Australia. When you have an international crisis, then coordinate. For example, a good example that the listeners could appreciate is that every season you have an outbreak of influenza. It's called seasonal flu. You guys in Australia get it in your summer and our winter, and get it in our summer and winter. And what happens is that when you make a vaccine for a particular season, the health authorities and the WHO decide what they predict is going to be the vaccine that would be most appropriate for the flu outbreak in that season. And that's one that's decided on a global level.
Yeah.
And so there is that kind of uniformity because we're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
If you have a global outbreak of flu, you know, you guys generally, if you look at it, we generally follow what you guys have. Like when you had an H1N1 year, we had an H1N1 year. When you guys had an H3N2 year, we had an H3N2 year. And H3 and N2 are just a designation of the kind of influenza A that you get. So the answer to your question is that there really is kind of a global look at this as opposed to a provincial individual country look.
Yeah. Okay. And Melissa, I know in Australia and probably in the United States as well, but in Australia, you and I have discussed the idiocy of anti-vaxxers. I mean,
look, the US is having its worst measles outbreak, I don't know, since the vaccine. It's scary, actually, I think. You know, I'm really glad I'm not a pediatrician.
Yeah, we're having a big problem, Nick and Melissa. We now have, in the first 4 months of 2019, we have 764 cases of measles, 460 of which are in New York City.
Oh.
And what happens is that there are pockets of people who, for reasons that one cannot understand, they're based on misinformation, libertarianism taken to its extreme about they don't want medical authorities to tell them what to do. When you get below a certain level of the community vaccination with measles, then you wind up getting a vulnerable community. And then when people come in from outside the country, where there's measles all over the world, if someone comes in and gets into that community, then you have a big outbreak. And that's exactly what's happening in the United States now. We're very concerned about it. As Melissa said correctly, this is the worst year we've had since we declared it eliminated in 2000, and the worst year in two decades, 25 years.
And that alludes to my question. So the World Health Organization, I think Melissa actually was in Manila for a meeting there fairly recently, but I was alluding to it because you've got an international body which it may set the guidelines, but there's a vast difference between suggesting and recommendations and then enforcement. And now there's obviously no great answer to it, right? The same thing applies in any kind of international standard because you have the separate thing or the separate standards on the federal territory or the nation state. But I was just sort of working through my mind how devastating it is if those policies, which you can't strap someone down, maybe you can in the, but you can't.
So one of the things that's happened in Australia to promote vaccines is that in Australia, parents get a rebate when if they send their kids to kindy or preschool, they get a rebate, but they only get that rebate if the immunisation record is up to date.
Okay.
And that was brought in Australia a few years ago.
Is it something, no play? Or what was the?
Yeah, well, no jab, no play is the catchphrase. Yeah. And, there are wealthier anti-vaxxers who say, well, I don't need the rebate. So it only works to a point. And other people will say, well, I don't want my kids to go to kindy. But certainly immunisation records, and they have improved in most pockets since that policy was brought in.
So because of the devastation that a potential massive measles outbreak could cause, is there any then just cause to actually go hard and say you will get fines or you will be imprisoned if you do not pursue a vaccination course? I guess that's obviously going the authoritarian route, but if it's for the greater good of the herd, I don't know.
Well, that's exactly, Nick, what's happening in, in New York right now. It's so frustrating for the health authorities that the mayor of New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio, has said that if you are going into a public place that's enclosed and you don't have a vaccine documentation, that you can get fined $1,000. The people who felt, understandably, but you know, felt that this was an encroachment on their civil liberties, they sued, and the court agreed with the fining, and they said that this was a public health issue. It's a health emergency. There is a big debate now about role the state and local authorities can have in trying to as much as possible. I don't want to use the word coerce because that has a pejorative sound to it, but to really address this, what really is a public health emergency. In many of the schools, unless you have a documentation of your vaccination, you can't get in to a school. But what they get around that by this thing called a philosophical objection. A valid objection for not vaccinating your child, particularly with a live attenuated vaccine like measles, mumps, rubella, is if they have an underlying medical condition where they're immunosuppressed and they could get into trouble with the vaccine. That's a very valid reason not to. Then there are those who claim religious reasons, but there are precious few religions that officially say you shouldn't be vaccinated, that people say, well, it's my own personal religion. And then there's the broad category of philosophical, which means I don't want to vaccinate him because I want to decide what happens to my child. The only thing with that approach is that what you're avoiding and not addressing is not only is the vaccine important for the health and safety of your own child, but you have a communal societal responsibility because there are people in the community who either can't get vaccinated for one reason or another, including children from birth to 12 months. You don't vaccinate kids. And there's a lot of people that are immunosuppressed with cancer, chemotherapy, with congenital immunodeficiencies. We have a moral responsibility to protect them. So it's nice to say, I decide what happens to my child. You're relinquishing a responsibility that you have to society.
And, in the same way that you're not allowed to bring peanut butter and peanuts to a, you know, a kindy anymore because you worry about other kids with anaphylaxis. You know, it's not just your child who can't have peanut butter on their toast. I think it is a communal responsibility to improve the health of our children.
Yeah, and I guess putting that argument when you outline it like that, does that help in any way when you're talking with someone who's hardline against necessary vaccinations or?
No, you know, there are. Melissa and I have the same.
You both look exact. You've got exactly the same posture right now.
I think you know it's like arguing anything that's against logic.
Yeah.
You know, our logic is sound.
Yeah.
But I'm not the person who has a different logic.
Yeah.
I just can't see that logic.
Yeah, and you know what? This is
we're right.
It's quite an intersection of the technology stuff that I look at, you know, which is more my area of focus and your guys' area of focus. This is the impact of contrived and constructed news and news that bounces around on social media. That's got a massive part to play in the avalanche of anti-vax.
And the influencers on social media, I think, have a real responsibility, you know, should have a real responsibility. These kind of non-superstar people who have made a statement and therefore the statement stands. And then it gets shared on Twitter and Facebook and whatever platform happens. And it spreads like wildfire and it's with no evidence base.
The good thing about the internet and some social media is that it's a good way to spread good and important information.
Yeah.
The bad news about it is that it's a really bad way to spread really bad information. And some of the reluctance to get vaccinated is really based on incorrect, false information and misinformation. For example, this myth that measles, mumps, rubella vaccines cause autism.
Autism, that's the big one, isn't it? That's the one that went wrong.
Has been completely debunked multiple times. It originated from a fraudulent paper from a physician in the UK, been called out and completely shown to be fabricated. The person lost their medical license in the UK, and yet still it lingers on the social media that this type of vaccine or any vaccine causes autism when it has been debunked multiple times. It's so difficult to get bad information. It's like putting toothpaste back into the tube. It's very tough.
And the mechanisms to actually approve the authenticity of something that has already been debunked. That's it's a very, very complex one. But there are technologists kind of working on that as well, which will, fingers crossed, have a positive impact on every single type of community that's connected to it, including the medical community, try to convince people out of these crazy myths. I think we'll probably move on into to the final section. And Melissa, did you have any questions that you had a burning desire to ask at the moment?
Not specifically. I think it's been a really interesting, slightly meandering conversation about But I've known you for a while, Nick, so yeah, I suspected that would be the case.
Only your sister can tell you that, Nick.
I won't take offence. That's my strategy, meander. Look, if you, Dr. Fauci, I guess the final questions are several kind of rapid-fire questions. When you're presenting to, I think, from what I heard, it was six presidents and the National Security Advisory Council, and indeed you've got the Presidential Medal, don't you, which is the highest civilian award. The types of endorsement support that you receive in NIAID and also for activities outside of the NIAID, have all six presidents from different parties been fairly supportive, understanding, and also educated about these subjects and enthusiastic about the support?
You know, the answer is in general, yes, with variability. The thing that we have been fortunate of in the United States is that there are some presidents who personally have taken a very a specific interest in certain global and public health issues.
Yep.
And in those that didn't, because they were involved in other things, the Congress continually gave us the kind of support that we need from a biomedical research and a public health standpoint.
Mm.
So I became director of the Institute when Ronald Reagan was president. And in the beginning, he got sorely criticized, even though I was trying to get him to talk more about HIV. He didn't use the bully pulpit of the presidency to kind of bring attention to the fact that we were dealing with a burgeoning epidemic. There were a lot of very good things about him as a president, and I enjoyed working with him, but when you look at the historical evaluation, the activists at least say he should have been more proactive.
Yeah.
George H.W. Bush, on the other hand, even when he was vice president, he came to me and actually came right here to the NIH where I'm sitting right now.
Mm.
And show him around with his wife, Barbara, to take a look at patients and understand what it's like to be HIV infected. Mm. And that's support for HIV AIDS went very, very high. President Clinton, he was very interested in those types of issues, as was his wife, the First Lady. Hillary Clinton was as interested as he was, and she did a lot of very good things during that presidency. George W. Bush it will be remembered in a very, very positive way when he asked me to go to Africa to see if we could put together a program that would alleviate some of the suffering and the death of Africans, because at that time, it was 2002 when he sent me. He asked me to see if we could put together a transforming program. So I went back one of many, many times that I've been there and looked around and said, we could probably, really translate the kinds of drugs and prevention that we were doing in the developed world, that we were doing in the USA, that you guys were doing in Australia. Mm. We could very likely get that done in Africa. So I came back and I proposed putting together a massive program. He was totally supportive. It was his idea, and he deserves all the credit in the world for the PEPFAR program, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. So there's an example of a president making a historic decision about putting billions of dollars. And in the words that he used when we discussed it was, I feel that as a rich nation, we have a moral responsibility to alleviate the suffering and death of people who are unfortunate enough to be born in a place that doesn't have the resources to do it. And that's how, and that's all on him. That was all his credit. President Obama was somebody who, as soon as he walked into office, we had all of these outbreaks of diseases. We had the first pandemic of the 21st century, the H1N1. He got very involved in that. We had the Ebola outbreak first in West Africa and now in DRC. He got involved in the Ebola and the Zika. So there was a president who we met with dozens of times because he was interested in making sure we did the right thing. And then most recently now, we have a situation where we have another outbreak in the DRC. So we've been fortunate that we have had administrations and Congress that have been very sensitive to the support of global health.
Well, that's fantastic. And I guess because of that massive amount of, you mentioned $3 billion initially from George W. Bush in...
It was $15 billion over 5 years for PEPFAR. But the budget for the research that we do here at NIH is $3 billion a year for AIDS research.
Gotcha. But you had that platform existing back in the Bush days so that when you had to contend with the current outbreaks of Ebola, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you already have some of the infrastructure there. Is that right?
Yeah. The funding was for HIV specifically.
Yeah. Okay. See, the platform was for HIV. But you bring up an important point, Nick, because... The fact that we built some infrastructure for treating HIV in Africa has put them well positioned for when other outbreaks occur.
Yeah. And is it,
credibility of yourself, as the director of the Institute has followed through that whole time. So I think that's not to be understated either.
The collaboration, so for example, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation doing work on mosquito nets and stuff like that. Is there a lot of collaboration with the NIAID?
Yeah. Yes, I'm glad you asked that question. You know, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is a godsend. We collaborate very intensively with them, and Bill himself comes to the NIH every year, sits down with me and with the director of NIH this year, Francis Collins, and I and Bill Gates sat down and plotted what we can do together to collaborate on any of a number of things, tuberculosis, malaria, HIV. It's amazing what that foundation has done. It's just extraordinary.
I've never met him, but director for the Spanish Agency for Development mentioned that he was working in Mozambique as the country director. Bill came in, had a chat with him, and although Bill's a technologist, he knew more about the science than some of the scientists did.
He's gotten very, very good at it. You know, I joke with him, tell him we're going to give him an honorary PhD.
Yeah, it sounds like he might deserve it. Look, guys, I think we've reached the end. We kind of touched on some of the security aspect. But bottom line, it sounds like, the thing to look out for is more of a naturally occurring pathogen. And in the meantime, kind of build up those mitigation strategies and maintain the international collaboration and try our best we can to convince anti-vaxxers that they're silly. Well, good luck for everyone.
We'll work on that.
Thanks, Nick. It's great being with you. And Melissa, I'll see you in Mexico City, huh?
See you in Mexico in July.
Thank you so much, everyone. Ciao.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all. The project is supported by iZoom Technology Consulting, global company specializing in cybersecurity, technological innovation for clients in defense and the private sector, and it's hosted on the Agenda Digitale website, an online news source reporting breaking news in tech and associated policy.